We all set? Okay, we'll move to the third case of the morning. Knights Ace versus Orma Vandershock and Gordon Brownlee. Who's first here? Mr. Cohen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court. This is a consolidated appeal involving Orma Van Schoik, who was convicted as an accessory to assisting Efren Mariscal in evading capture by federal authorities. The second appeal of Gordon Brownlee, he was convicted as a principal. There is a distinction between the accessory statute and the principal statute. In the government's brief, the government asserts that it didn't have to prove that there were 1,000 plants of marijuana in this case because the statute does not require the government to prove that. The difference is for an accessory, the accessory statute does have a knowing or knowledge element to it, which would require the government when charging someone as an accessory.
Suppose she was aware that 999 marijuana plants were involved in Mariscal's underlying offense. Under your theory, would she have to be acquitted of being an accessory after the fact because she didn't know it was precisely 1,000 plants?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. And the reason for that, I believe, is because the accessory statute does require the knowledge element.
So where do we draw the line at 999?
Well, we would draw the line at the proof that requiring the government to prove that it was more than 1,000 plants. And if the government failed to do that, then in that particular case, they would have failed to prove an essential element of the case.
So tell me this, is her sole argument on appeal that she didn't know how many marijuana plants were involved? Or is it also her defense that she slept through Mariscal's visit and had no idea he came to the house, so she, you know, played no part in aiding him?
It's a combination of both at trial. In fact, she defended the case on the basis she was unaware that Efren Mariscal was there asking for assistance. That issue has already been decided against her in the district court. So here on appeal, Your Honor, I have narrowed the argument to encompass the requirement that the government had to prove that knowledge in this case. But otherwise, that would have been a defense.
You mean...
Had the jury believe that.
So you're not still arguing that she had to know
that she had to know that there was more than 1,000 plants? Yes, I'm still
that's
arguing.
That's it.
Yes.
You've dropped anything else about, you know, Mariscal.
Well, I think it goes to the issue of whether there was sufficient evidence or not. I think it goes to the aspect of proving that the government was required to prove that she had more than that there were more than 1,000 plants.
She knew there was something going on. She just didn't know how much.
Well, if you look at the circumstantial evidence that in the light most favorable to the government here on appeal, I suppose you can make an argument that there was some general knowledge that she had as far as something going on because the police told her that there were some escapees. However, the government actually charged her in this case with possession in excess of 1,000 plants. And once the government did that, as an accessory, they were required to prove that she knew about that. The one case that I cited in my brief, the Burnett case from the Ninth Circuit, I think is very illustrative of this point. In that case, the accessory was charged as an accessory to a felon in possession of a weapon. And the Ninth Circuit Burnett said if the accessory did not know that there was a felony conviction, that the principal had a felony conviction, then the principal or the accessory couldn't be convicted of that crime, because the accessory statute required the knowledge element to be proven. And if in that case the accessory was unaware that the principal had a prior felony conviction, couldn't be convicted. Similar in this case, by analogy, if the government had to prove that there were 1,000 plants in order to convict her as an accessory of exceeding 1,000 plants. If they failed to do that, and likewise, they failed to prove their case.
So just to be absolutely sure, you have now dropped your argument that she didn't know the precise crime that the fugitive who came to her house had committed. That's out of the case.
Well, that was the position in the district court. If you look at the facts, I wish I could say that to this court, but I think I'm constrained by the rules of appellate procedure.
Okay, so that's out of this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'd like to present that to you, but I don't believe I can.
Yeah.
And by presenting it on the basis that the government was required to prove that, I think the other case that I cited from the Ninth Circuit, they said that if the principal was charged with armed robbery, then in order for the accessory to be convicted of armed robbery as an accessory, they had to know that the principal was armed. Similarly, in this case, if the principal is charged with possession of more than 1,000 plants, then the government has to prove that knowledge element, that there were more than 1,000 plants, and that Orma Van Schwoik knew that.
The difference, though, counsel, is that for armed robbery, the being armed part is an element of the offense, and similarly for felon in possession, the prior felony conviction is an element of the offense, and that's not the situation here.
That is correct. It is not quite the situation here, but I think that you can use that same logic and argument, because the guidelines, as they're applicable here, elevated her sentence to more than 1,000 plants. And so I think that she is entitled then to require the government to prove that as well, in order for the government to use that as a bootstrap to give her a sentence exceeding 1,000 plants. So therefore it becomes, under the accessory statute, I think it becomes an element, and that the government is required to prove that.
Even though it's not an element of the underlying offense?
Even though it's not an element of the underlying offense, yes. Yes.
You're saying that she has to know the type, the quantity, precisely, and wouldn't that hinder prosecution of all but the very most organized drug dealers who keep precise records of their drug quantities?
Well, I think the accessories...
out there counting every plant.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the accessory statute was designed for that purpose, though. That if you look at it, she was just charged as the accessory. And because she was charged as the accessory, that knowledge requirement is there, and the government is required then to prove that the number of plants in this case.
Is this your cohort's turn?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you going to argue now? Okay, you're Mr. Caramanchi? Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Ashwin Caramanchi, and I represent the appellant, Gordon Brownlee. Brownlee argues on appeal that the trial court committed plain error when it issued what is known as the deliberate avoidance or ostrich instruction. Under plain error review, Mr. Brownlee must first establish error. In this case, the critical question that the jury had to answer is simple to pose. What did Brownlee know? Did he know that cooperating witnesses Bautista and Mariscal were on his property to plant marijuana, or did he believe that they were on his property for legitimate purposes such as hunting or other activities?
Well, let's go over the evidence. Number one, he's dropping people off near the marijuana plot on several occasions. He himself would never go into the plot. despite the fact that he is dropping strangers off in the same area of his property again and again. He never discusses with them why they're there, what they're doing. These men that he's driving are carrying picks and machetes. It seems to be quite a lot of evidence of deliberate indifference, doesn't it?
Your Honor, Mr. Brownlee had a 3-year friendship with Bautista, and the area where he dropped individuals off, that area was known for hunting, fishing. It was a wooded area next to the Kankakee River. And in fact, Bautista and Mariscal both testified that they went hunting in that area during the summer.
With picks and machetes.
There was one trip where Mariscal testified that, yes, he transported picks and machetes to that general area.
And they never have game or fishing poles. I mean, doesn't it point to an ostrich-like instruction?
Your Honor, in Carrillo, the court made the point that the defendant may have had some knowledge that things were not as they seemed. But I think the circumstances that Mr. Brownlee confronted were not inherently suspicious. If Brownlee had, in Carrillo, the court made a point that a defendant's knowledge of his cohort's prior involvement with drugs, prior involvement with illegal activities, is a significant factor in determining whether or not to issue an ostrich instruction. In this case, Mariscal and Bautista had no prior involvement. There was no evidence that they had any prior involvement with illegal activities, such that a jury could infer, based on Brownlee's 3-year relationship with Bautista, that he would have known of their illegal activities.
I have two minor questions. I'm minor. One is, I thought I saw something where, when escaping, someone ran through a cornfield. Was there a cornfield proximate to this or surrounding these plots?
There is, Your Honor. Mr. Brownlee's house is located a mile south of the Kankakee River. The marijuana plot was located north of that river, and in between the house and the river, there are cornfields with stalks that go up 6 feet high, as well as a wooded area where individuals often hunted or fished. And as I said before, Bautista and Mariscal both testified that during that summer they, in fact, did go hunting in that area.
I don't know what they were hunting for during the summer, but that doesn't really matter. Were these plant fields surrounded by a cornfield, or just adjacent to one, or what?
The marijuana plot was located north of the river. The cornfields were located south of the river.
You were across the river in order to run through the cornfield?
I believe that there are other cornfields located around the area of the marijuana.
I'm trying to picture it because, I'm no farm boy. And, the cases that I've seen in the past is they surround these things with corn. So the owner of the farm knows what's going on, and the corn screens out, and they only saw this one from the air. So I'm just, again, these are minor questions. I'm sort of curious what was going on and why Mr. Brownlee had no idea what was going on in his property. I assume he didn't grow corn anywhere.
He did not. The farmland was leased out to various individuals.
I see.
They, in fact, testified that five defense witnesses testified that Brownlee never told them to not go into that area. Defense witness Van Dierendonk was the one who farmed that cornfield, and he testified that he never noticed anything suspicious, that Brownlee never informed him that he shouldn't go into that area. Other witnesses also testified that they asked Brownlee if they could hunt in that area or fish on the river, and he gave them permission. He never sought to keep people away from that area. So I think that goes to show that he himself was not suspicious that anything was going on. I think that's the standard, not a reasonable person standard, but whether the defendant himself actually strongly suspected criminal activity.
And those people all testified at trial.
They did. And ultimately, Your Honor, this verdict is not reliable. The district judge himself expressed doubts about the weight of the government's evidence. After Brownlee moved for a judgment of acquittal at the conclusion of the government's case in chief, the trial court denied the motion but said, I have some concerns, to be perfectly frank, but at this point I'll deny it. This demonstrates that the evidence concerning Brownlee's knowledge is subject to enough dispute that a rational jury could have found that he was in fact not guilty of the crime charged. And I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Holler?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, David Holler on behalf of the government. I guess I'd just like to clarify a few of your factual questions before returning to Ms. Van Skoik. I believe that there are some maps and there's good descriptions in the evidence. There's a farmhouse at the far north end of the property. There's then a large area that's being farmed that was corn, sometimes beans, but it was corn that particular year. Then you get into some wooded area. There's a bit of a clearing, which is where this marijuana plot was being grown. Then there's more woods along, and then you get to the Little Kankakee River, which is where
it was isolated. It wasn't planted in the middle of a cornfield.
It was an isolated area. It was not planted in the middle of the cornfield. The cornfield was being leased. The farmer testified and said, essentially, on direct, he said, I was never told not to go into the woods. And on cross, he said, I never would have gone into the woods. I'm a farmer. I don't go into the woods. I farm the land. So that it would have essentially aroused more suspicion if the defendant had come and said, by the way, don't go into the woods. I mean, it's again, part of the whole deliberate avoidance strategy, which is why the ostrich instruction was appropriate. The idea that the defendant could, if somebody happened to stumble onto the property, which in a wide open space like this, there's always at least some possibility that might occur, he could claim, I had no idea what was going on. Let's get this out of here. That was, I believe, what the intent was, assuming that the property would have been stumbled on when the workers weren't there, which they were only there once every week or two. There's one witness who testifies, Mr. Dadlow, who testifies on direct, that I wanted to go down and take my trailer down and kind of go down in this farm lane that the defendant took the Mexican workers down. And he said, oh, yeah, you can do that, but I got to mow it, and I haven't mowed it yet. And then he said, well, I'll just go down with my wife. Well, don't go down with your wife because there's too many mosquitoes. She won't want you to go down there. But if you want to go, you can, but you're going to get eaten alive. It's a very clear case of deliberate avoidance, we believe, Your Honors. So on the drug quantity question, Your Honors, we would submit that in an accessory after the fact case, the defendant must be aware that a federal offense has been committed. They must be aware of conduct on the part of the offender that satisfies the essential elements of a particular offense. And while I don't agree entirely with all of the language in the Ninth Circuit cases, we do believe essentially that they reach the right conclusions. If I assist someone who has a firearm and I don't know that they're a felon, I don't know that they are not allowed to have a firearm, it's hard to see how I'm an accessory after the fact. But in this case, Ms. Van Skoik, moving now to the other defendant, was well aware that an offense had been committed, that a crime had been committed. She was sitting on her porch when Corey Keller came and told her, there's a marijuana growing in your field. There are Mexicans who are running away from the scene. We are trying to catch them. If one of them comes, don't let them into your house. Please call 911. This is what is going on. And the evidence from the record from Mr. Mariscal is that instead he knocked on the door. Ms. Van Skoik's brother let him in, and she then assisted him. She directed him to her shower. She brought him fresh clothes. She allowed him to shave the mustache, and she assisted him in those actions. So the accessory after the fact statute is a harboring a felon statute, is taking acts to aid, abet, or harbor someone who has committed an offense, and that is what occurred in this particular case. Ultimately, Mr. Cohen seems to be making the argument to me that essentially this somehow affected her statutory maximum for the offense, but if one were to trace this down, even if one were to agree with his position, I think you're going to now be in an 841A1D situation where it's some amount of marijuana that's being possessed with the intent to distribute. The maximum offense for that would still be 30 months, which is still more than the sentence that she, in fact, received. So it doesn't seem to me to have any effect, and this court has been abundantly clear over the years, as this came up numerous times shortly after Apprendi, that the sentencing factors, that the quantity of drugs is a sentencing factor, and it's not the case. It's never the case that we have to prove that Mr. Brownlee himself or Mr. Bautista or Mr. Mariscal themselves knew that there were 1,000 plants. If they thought, gosh, you know, we only brought in seeds and we thought there were only going to be 780, it wouldn't make any difference to their offense. And it doesn't make any difference here as long as she knows that there's that crime going on.
Well, they said something about the third largest or second largest in the history of Indiana or something.
No, largest, Your Honor.
Largest.
This is the largest that we've discovered, largest in Indiana, they believe. By quite a long shot. I think this was...
So there are more than 1,000. What was it, 2,800 or something?
I think it was 2,600. It's in the brief. 2,687. It's
okay.
6, 7, and 8 in some order or another. It's well over 1,000 plants. And that's what we have to demonstrate ultimately is that there were more than 1,000 plants. We have to have that amount correct. But just like in the drug context, the defendant can't come in and say, I thought that it was 4.9 grams of crack because I weighed it out at home. And you charge me with 5. That the same principle ultimately applies here. We believe there was sufficient evidence. The question that was raised at trial as to whether she was secreted off in her room and it was another woman who was doing this and Mr. Mariscal made a improper identification, that's a fact question that the jury resolved against Ms. Van Skoik, who did testify, whose credibility was at issue in this case, and the jury heard her testimony, and they heard Mr. Mariscal's testimony, and they believe Mr. Mariscal. And ultimately, we believe that the legal sufficiency argument that is being raised here at this point fails. The other issue that she raised regarding the mention of Mr. Bautista's conviction should not have been admitted. It was irrelevant, but we also believe it was clearly harmless. She's not a co-conspirator of him where someone would think that because he's guilty of the crime, she might be as well. And she wasn't even, he really had very little involvement in the case. I believe that it may have been entered just as an attempt to sort of flesh out for the jury what was going on and not let them believe we had kind of gone after the small fish and let the big fish go.
She wasn't charged with assisting Bautista, only Mariscal.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yes. We had no evidence, Your Honor, that she knew or took any steps to aid what was going on her boyfriend's property. And Mr. Bautista was arrested at the scene prior to really all of the events that are being discussed here. They find the grow operation going on. Mr. Bautista is in the company of Wayne Brownlee, who is Gordon Brownlee's brother. He's there. They ask him, what are you doing here? You know, you're from Chicago. What are you doing here in LaPorte County, Indiana? And he says, I'm assisting some workers picking corn. Well, they knew they weren't picking corn, so they had probable cause to arrest him. And they took him away. And they then said, you know, to everybody, there's like 11 people in this house. And they're telling them all, they're not letting anyone leave the scene. There were some overnight guests and things, too. And they said, we're still searching for all of these other people who have run away. Help us out here. Call 911. And again, this isn't a Good Samaritan case. If the defendant had said, you know, I'm not calling the police, but I'm not letting Mr. Mariscal in, that's her right to do that. But what she doesn't have the right to do is to assist someone and try to help him escape, which is what she and her brother were trying to do. We're trying to help Mr. Mariscal escape. And so they're guilty of that offense after the fact. It seems to me, obviously it doesn't come up much, but it seems to me a fairly classic case of an use of accessory after the fact statute. So if the court has no further questions, we would simply ask that the judgments of both defendants be affirmed.
Okay, thanks. Someone had some time left, I think. Okay. Mr. Canamachi.
Your Honors, the government's entire case rested on the testimonies of Bautista and Mariscal. I would point out that they received substantial benefits for their testimonies, sentences of nearly 85%, 70% below the statutory minimums. Had the jury chosen to disbelieve their testimonies, I think we need to ask what effect the ostrich instruction would have had on their inquiry. The jury would have been pointed to circumstances of deliberate avoidance that did not exist in considering the evidence that remained. And the risk is that those circumstances demonstrate negligence, not knowledge. And the risk is significant that the jury could have convicted Mr. Brownlee for what he should have known about the circumstances that he confronted as opposed to what he actually knew. And I would again point to the district court's statement in denying the judgment of acquittal that he himself expressed doubts about the weight of the government's evidence. And unless the court has further questions, I'll conclude.
Okay, thanks. Thanks to both counsel. I understand both of you were court appointed. Is that correct? Great. Well, thanks very much for taking the assignment and the good work you did for your client.